sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
It was a big weekend for sports fans. April closes with slight gains for the equity indices. Social media stocks are slammed. And we have a guest today, a good one. Benzinga founder and CEO Jason Raznick will be joining us. All this and much more on episode number 411 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, happy May to you. I hope you enjoyed your April. That was a lot of fun towards the end of the days there, towards the end of the month, where we had that bit of a roller coaster ride. Who knows what that was for? I did some research on that. If you're looking for any excuses, reasons, or just some kind of understanding of what happened at the end of April, it seems like everybody's talking about just simply rebalancing robo-trades, robo-accounts, kind of the algorithms gone a little bit wild with no excuse really why markets sold off as they did towards the end of the month. But it did. It was a pretty rough day right before the last day of the month. And as you would know, we hopped back right away. And that is kind of part and parcel of what's happening with markets these days. The excess liquidity is forcing most people to believe that the buy on the dip is all that's required. Those dips can be very shallow, 1% or so, and it's a buying opportunity. Meanwhile, we did see that there was an extreme amount of volatility in certain sectors. We saw, for example, that the biotech area just got absolutely obliterated on Thursday, came back a bit on Friday, but there was some concern that there was some significant overvaluations in that area. Social media also got slammed pretty well. That was a really interesting situation. I guess we'll talk about that because we did see that there was a leak of data out of Twitter. Seems that the way that Twitter posted, or actually it wasn't Twitter, it was one of the sites that actually has the information about where their particular earnings were released. So the way that they set it up was, let's say, www.earningsreleases.com or whatever the site was, /Twitter Q2 2015. In other words, in the past, they had a similar type of style of the URL formed for the release of the data, and they didn't use any kind of hashing or any other kind of differential when it came to looking at what the earnings were and what the earnings announcement would be posted as. So at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the day that Twitter was releasing their earnings, we saw that there was this, all of a sudden, this move. Twitter started coming down pretty hard. No reason cited initially. There was nothing that anybody could find. And then there was a quick note that, hey, wait a minute, maybe this is the actual earnings. We're seeing from a particular site that did some crawling of websites and found this earnings release. At the time, it was still a rumor. There really wasn't an understanding of whether the information that was put out, because it was monthly active users, which is a lot lower than anticipated, and their earnings were a little bit on target, but some of the outlook was questionable, and the stock was down, I don't know, 3, 4, 5%. And there really wasn't a, I guess it would be confirmation of this by anybody, especially Twitter, when this happened. But meanwhile, the stock was moving. Well, lo and behold, they finally halted the stock. And when it opened back up, it was down like 20%. Because there was some concern about the outlook. And the outlook was pretty poor. Now, the CEO of the company, who I've lost a lot of respect for over the last several quarters, they keep on changing all the metrics that go into creating what the particular looks are and what is a page view slash is a user slash is an active user, what is the actual metric that you want to look at? And Twitter keeps on changing that as to the one that you want to look at and the one that you want to actually see as the most important one. And it's confusing. I mean, it's really confusing. How in the world are we supposed to follow a stock and understand it if the CEO is coming on saying, well, that doesn't matter. And the reason that we lost all these users last period was because of some change in the way the Apple iPhone did whatever they do. And then he comes out with another excuse the next quarter. And then he says, you know, we're going to change what you really should be looking at. Analysts, do me a favor. Don't look at what we said last quarter. Look at what we're telling you now, because it's a lot better, of course. And this is what's gone on with Twitter for some time. Dick Costello, who is the CEO, I think, or Costello, is I think, subject to a lot of scrutiny right now. And especially with the poor numbers that they're putting up. Now, there's more excuses, by the way. Now they're looking at, well, you know, one of the things is that we had not as much, when they look at the advertising, there wasn't as much clicks. And, well, we're really working on this, and we think it's going to be very successful, but. And the sales team put in all the stuff, but, you know, there wasn't as much take up and use of the clicks and the crap, absolute crap, trying to put all this information in front of us to make us believe that things are really good. And that's why, finally, the stock took it on the chin where they should have. There really was nothing wrong with their earnings this quarter. Actually, it was pretty good. Overall, when you look at the earnings and all the numbers they put up, it was fine. It was a decent amount. Did it really warrant a 20% rock down the first day or so, and then another, I don't know, 8% after that? You know, stock is down pretty substantially from where it was right before the earnings release. I don't know if it really deserves that kind of punishment, but I think the punishment is more so with the management and the information the management's providing, the confusion factors, and that's why the stock sold off. There's a lack of confidence in management right now. I'm even starting to see tweets and other various news murmurs and discussion about, well, wouldn't it be beneficial if Twitter went private? Well, of course it would be beneficial. You know why? Because the management would not be accountable to anybody at that point. It would be internal. But we'll see what happens with Twitter. On the heels of that, we also saw that LinkedIn disappointed significantly with their outlook. Now, their discussion was due to the fact they bought this, I think it's called Lynda, L-Y-N-D-A. They bought this, and the total cost factors involved, the expenses involved, and the lack of any earnings from it that will substantially increase their bottom line moving forward over the next quarter or so. The stock took about a 20% hit or so. I mean, it was down very substantially after the close, and it continued to sell off through the regular market hours on Friday. So we're seeing that there is a bit of the excess amount of air that is being removed from some of the highly elevated earnings multiples from many of these companies. Yelp is another one that came in pretty hard. Facebook was able to withstand much of this, but we are seeing that there is a concern now across the board in social media stocks whether or not they're going to be able to capitalize on earnings and capitalize on their advertising that they're trying to do, because that's their main source of revenue, of course. One of the things that I think is really interesting is a few months ago, I talked about this on the DH Unplugged show, that if in fact companies are doing what they can to cut back on expenses because they're seeing dollar headwinds, they're seeing a slowdown in the economy, and they're seeing a slowdown in their international growth, will they actually not only start reducing headcount possibly, but do things like the share buybacks that we've talked about to increase their earnings and increase their level of scrutiny on overall expenses? And one of the things that they're going to do is cut back on advertising. And as they cut back on advertising, where are they going to look to do so? One of the places may be, and is showing through, is with the non-proven social media. Now, Facebook has a much better track record, much better mousetrap than some of these other players, and maybe that's what's happening right now. We're seeing that many companies are cutting back on some of their advertising expenses and their campaigns, and what's happening is maybe it's showing through. Maybe it's actually coming right through down to the bottom line of Twitter, LinkedIn, Yelp, etc., And that's what we're seeing. Now, this was just a hypothesis of mine several months ago. And really, we're still not seeing that that's absolute at this point. But we are seeing that there is some weakness that is expected. And as such, many of these stocks are starting to really take a nose down. And you need to watch this. There's some trading opportunities clearly available. There's still a lot of optimism by many investors, traders in these positions. So I'd watch for much of these to be possibly bought on some of these drops 3, 4, 5 days out for a little bit of a rise. But if nothing changes and we continue to see the economics as they are and companies talking about weak guidance into the next quarter or so, we may be able to figure that there is continuing potential for many of these companies to have problems, particularly those that rely primarily and only on advertising revenue. I have some listener questions I wanted to get to. I have some discussion about the fight from this weekend, some interesting stuff that I want to talk about, as well as what's going on around the world and what to expect the next week. But I thought we'd get first to our guest. And our guest today, Jason Raznick. He's the founder and CEO of Benzinga and MarketFi. You may have heard of them, you may not, but we're going to get into it because I have been using it. This is a great tool, and I'm always on the search for looking to find those great tools that are out there that maybe that we're uncovering, maybe that not, but I want to talk a little bit about this because it's going to help you in your trading and understanding of the market. So, Jason, all the way from Michigan, how are you?
Good. How are you, Andrew? How's everything?
Everything's good down here, thanks. You know, we've known each other a long time. I think, have you ever been a guest before?
I don't think so. I've been an active listener, but yeah, I don't know if I've been a guest. Maybe a few years ago. I don't know, but I it's definitely been a while.
Well, I wanted to talk to you about this whole, really, I guess you've really done an incredible job over the last year or so, really branching out and bringing an incredible amount of data into Benzinga. You have Benzinga, the baseline. You also have the Pro Series. So kind of, I wanted to back up, first of all, you know, what was the initial idea when you created Benzinga and where it is today?
It was, you know, there was no one covering small cap news. There was no agnostic news provider. When an event happened on small cap stocks, there was no one covering that. Back in 2001, after 9/11, I became in the defense sector. I became pretty knowledgeable and I had a big following on small cap defense stocks, from Envision to Bursar, a bunch of them. And I had a big following. Many years later, I'm like, I want to create a small cap newswire. And that's how the genesis of the idea came about. And the idea was, you know, this is where we enter, and it's going to go a lot more horizontal and go to different verticals. We've thus far stuck to the money vertical and finance mainly. But that was how it originally started. And, you know, Ameritrade came to us and really liked what we were doing with the small cap stuff. And that was basically how it started in the, you know, basement of a home.
But it's not like that now. I mean, now you're covering all aspects.
Yeah.
And you know, you've really broadened it.
Yeah. So now we are a data and news vendor. I mean, we are covering, you know, all markets pretty much, almost 24/7. We have a whole newsroom, you know, with each person having 8 monitors and covering all markets, breaking stories. We break stories. We broke story on a BlackBerry to Tesla. We work directly with companies. It's a different game these days, where before there was just a couple media providers. There's different ones like a Benzinga that you wouldn't necessarily know Benzinga at first, but you keep seeing us break stories. We start establishing our name, and then we, you know, have earnings data that we believe is the most accurate earnings feed out there. So we, you know, it's becoming a full encompass, you know, financial media provider.
Now, for those of you who don't use, I've mentioned, for example, and this is probably, I would assume this is probably a competitor of yours, that I've for many years used Briefing.com, Briefing Trader. You know, one of the things they have is a kind of a multiple screen where you can see what's going on, some analysis, some news items, earnings items. And things. This is very, I don't want to say similar. I'm not trying to say anything negative or positive about it. I'm just saying if you know what I was talking about there, Benzinga Pro, for example, has a multi-screen split where it talks about different things of earnings news, breaking items. You know, I was kind of looking at it this morning, for example, and I saw, oh, there was some information about a particular stock, and there was a note just came out, and they gave you a link to, okay, well, this is a third party talking about the stock, stock's dropping. Or there was I think this morning there's something about on Abercrombie, there's a big spike. There was like a 25 or 30,000 share buy in all of a sudden, shares are spiking. This is to get you to understand more about what's happening. So what I'm seeing and I'm envisioning is you have this room full of people watching screens. They got some alerts on, hey, you see a high volume spike. What is it? Then finding out and then making some calls, I guess, and finding out like what's going on from the street and from research places, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So like, for example, yesterday there was a rumor that OVTI was going to be acquired. So we're seeing these rumors. We're checking on them. We're calling. So we even have a thing where you can ask our analysts. So it's our Benzinga Pro Mach 4. I think it's $239 a month. If you want to know why a stock is moving, you hit a button in Benzinga Pro and you get directed to directly to one of our analysts. And say you want to know why Yahoo's moving, let's say, and you don't see it on the feed. You look around the web. You don't see it. Our analysts, who are friends with the, work with the analysts that cover the stock on Wall Street. So our analysts may call the guy from Goldman and say, are you hearing anything about Yahoo? The analysts at Goldman may say, no, I don't know. And, I haven't heard anything, et cetera. So then our analysts will call the company and either reach, that to IR or the CEO. And we have a lot of contacts there being a media company. And Benzinga's content is distributed to, millions and millions of people a month now, not just on Benzinga, on different platforms. So we try to let people know why something's moving, or we alert them what could move. I mean, we aren't just an aggregator of content from everywhere. We break original stuff. We are an original vendor as well. So
one of the things you have is you have on the free site and your free Twitter feed, that is. I see, for example, earnings news flow through. Oh, estimates were 63 cents, came in at 62, revenues beat, whatever, just a quick line on Twitter. And then on the main site, you have things like charts, you have some economic data. But on the pro site, it's more of a constant flow of the most pertinent information, right?
Yeah, so there's a balance that we have to wrestle through. So, for example, that OVTI was acquired. On pro, you'd see that in real time. You would see when Twitter's earnings were leaked. You see that in real time. And it's a constant flow of news, data that impacts the market. There's probably 300 to 500 items a day. And you can customize it for your portfolio, the stocks that you own, for alerts. You can customize it so it's not too much noise and it's what you want it to be. But yeah, there's a 300 to 600 headlines a day. For example, it's earnings season right now. We have a whole team just working on earnings. It's very easy to automate earnings if you wanted to, but we really want to have the most accurate feed. So we're calling probably 50 to 100 companies a day to verify some things in their earnings reports. And thus we've built one of the, I would say, the most accurate earnings feed. And you'll find that in Pro, and you'll also in the BenzingaPro.com. And then on Benzinga, you may not always see the earnings reports. You may not see the buyouts because that's our free version. It's more just like, here's the content, here's interesting stories. It's not necessarily meant for the real-time customer.
So when it comes to looking at, for example, when it comes to looking at the target market, who's the most appropriate person for this?
The most appropriate person is someone that wants to be informed of the market, wants to be informed of a stock moving. They want to be first. They don't want someone else to know ahead of time.
Right.
I mean, we'll break stories from time to time. It could be the active day trader. It could be the prop trader. It could be a desk on Wall Street. Uh-huh. I mean, it's someone that wants to. That's what Benzinga Pro is for. It's someone that wants to know earnings dates in one place. They want to know when Tesla got upgraded. They want to know it first. They right. want they don't want to see it delayed on other networks, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. So they're going to look for I guess the active trader, this is really good for, right? I mean, the active trader is going to be the ones that you're going to find, a lot of information.
Yeah. It's definitely an active trader. I would say a lot of active trader, we get emails all the time about how much money Benzinga Pro has made someone save someone. We get emails all the time about that.
Yeah, I can tell you something.
That's why we're in business.
I can tell you that when we look at the level of information that flows a lot of times, and the headlines, poorly written headlines, misrepresented a lot of times from the headlines. I talk about this all the time. Don't just trade. Don't make any decisions just on headlines. When you start doing that, what happens is that you make a lot of mistakes because the headlines may say something, but the data really may be totally different. I mean, you find that a lot, right?
Yeah, I mean, and that's buyer beware in some respect, but you got to, there has to be clarity in why this is happening. And obviously the stock price movement predicts things as well. So you got to read into it. We try to give the color as to why something would be moving or what have you, but yeah, absolutely.
So I know you also have this Squawk feature. You know what Squawk is, and for people that don't, the old Squawk box was, there was some kind of a speaker, some kind of an input from various places, trading rooms and trading floors, and you would hear, you know, notes like GE, big volume, tick moving or whatever. You also have some kind of a Squawk system. What qualifies to go on the audio?
So we have people that are monitoring that. It's stuff that looks interesting, that could be moving, that big, high momentum stocks. Our audio is amazing. It's quick. It's useful. You don't need to look at your screen. You could just turn it on.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily what qualifies. It's like what's market moving? What is, something that just happened? It's stuff that you could trade on that you don't necessarily have to look at your screen to do. That's what qualifies.
Yeah, because I noticed when you have that on, and it's nice because it's a separate window. It's not everything that comes through. It's not just a constant barrage of somebody saying, this happened. A GDP announcement would be an example. A major earnings announcement, I guess, would be an example. A major stock move on volume would be an example. Maybe some kind of a news item around the world where there's going to be, some kind of a market moving event. A war breaks out or something like that, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So it's not noise that you just are distracted by. It's something that is impactful that, should impact your portfolio, and people once they have it, they can't live without it.
So you have, you've done a lot of work obviously to expand, to increase the news sources, to increase the new Benzinga Pro. You have the iPhone app and other apps as well. What kind of things are you, I'm kind of curious to know, what are you going to be? I know you, so I know you're always looking to enhance. What are you looking to enhance and add in the future?
I mean, we have decent distribution to a lot of different platforms, and there's a lot of people creating data sets or features or technology that we want to work with and help them, with distribution and help enhance ultimately tools for the average person. So we keep wanting to empower the average person to get tools and data as soon as people get it on Wall Street. So if there's a sentiment score on ratings, we want to give that to the average person. So, we built our MarketFi platform, MarketFi.com, to give people access to ex-hedge fund managers, and if they want to get color on why some stock is moving or why this happened in the market, that's what that's for. We have ideas of where we want to take this, with some proprietary indicators. We are the original vendors of, ratings, earnings, dividends, stock splits. We have a whole team that gathers that in real time, puts that out the most accurate. So maybe there'll be some indicators off that, some significant data points that we'll come out with. And of course, we want to break more stories, more interviews, etc. There's a lot of things in the roadmap, but just, how fast can we get to them?
Yeah. Well, I do want to recommend that even just to start looking around and poking around at what's available. We'll put the links on how to get this, because this is one of those things, again, I try not to do a lot of promotion. I think you know that by listening to the show. I don't do a lot of promotion, but when there's a product here and there that is something that could really benefit my listeners, I'm like, let's at least get it out there. I'm not getting paid. At least as far as I know, I'm not getting paid by Jason. I called him. I said, hey, come on the show. I want to talk about what's going on. But definitely I want you guys to check it out. Download the iPhone app. It gives you some good information, some real-time stock quotes on there, some news and things like that you can find. But on the Benzinga side as well, MarketFi and the Pro, is there I don't even know this answer. Is there a trial available for the Pro?
Yeah, I think it's tough. I think at BenzingaPro.com, there's a 14-day free trial. The Benzinga app, we're really proud of. It's just on iPhone, though, right now. It's very easy to use. There's a lot of cool little indicators, alerts, real-time news. So it's a different experience. BenzingaPro is a 14-day trial. You can call in and ask questions and, different data points and content that you're interested in. Again, accuracy is everything to us. We're going to break stories, but being accurate is so important because there's a lot of noise out there. And yeah, Andrew is, you know, used us, looked at us, and he's not, you know, making money off this. We just want to give you guys better information. That's what we're here for. If you have ideas on what kind of better real-time news you'd like to see or what have you, you know, we curate Twitter. We do a lot of that stuff. Let us know. My email is jason@benzinga.com as well. And obviously, Andrew, I'd love being on the show. It's one of my favorite podcasts.
Hey, I appreciate that. All right, we'll talk soon, and thanks for joining me, buddy.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.
All right, bye, Jason. Thanks so much again. Good stuff over at Benzinga. I really do encourage you again to check that out and see what is all available on the various platforms they have to offer, the things that you can get, because information, but not only information, quality information is really important in the everyday trading, investing, quality information, not only on a time basis, but also on the quality underlying data is extremely important, as you well know. All right, I want to talk about something that was interesting. So this weekend, I went to a couple different charity events. I went to the Kentucky Derby. It was to benefit, well, not to the Kentucky Derby. It was a Kentucky Derby event that was meant to actually raise money for a place down here called the Anstorck Center. It's for the profoundly handicapped individuals. And it was a kind of a cool party. Everybody was dressed up and all that. Then I went after that to another party and event, another charitable event function. It was really neat. Brought in a great band, great food. People raised a lot of money for the Broward Hospital District down here. Then I decided, okay, when I'm going to go home, I'm going to check out what's going on with the fight. I kind of started to do a few things and see if I can get any news. Nothing was really coming up, but the fight was about to start. And then I thought of, hey, you know, I just installed this thing called Periscope on my iPhone and my iPad, which is an app that is, it's part of Twitter now. And basically what it is that you can essentially broadcast and stream a video, audio and video, over this Periscope app. And as you would think, and as you would know, there are a lot of those folks out there that thought that would be a really great idea to rebroadcast a very expensive fight on this Periscope app. What they did was they held their iPhone, or I guess their iPad, up and took a video of the fight that was appearing on pay-per-view on TV. And there was tons of these. There was just a bunch of these people out there with these live streams. So I was able to actually watch the fight live for free. Quality wasn't that good. Sometimes the streams were shut down. Twitter was trying to shut these down. There were all sorts of lawsuits by the pay-per-view companies trying to shut these all down. But you know what? You put these apps out and this is what's going to happen. Now, I do wonder, going back to what we talked about with Twitter earlier about their earnings, et cetera, and how they're going to increase revenue, how they're going to increase engagement, how this Periscope app is going to do anything for that. It may bring on more people to use the app, and if they integrate it fully with Twitter, that may be interesting. But I still wonder, how is it that they're going to somehow create revenue from it? Right now, as it stands, it's video, and there's a couple of features on it, like you could tap it and put hearts and that you liked it, and you could put your comments in the bottom. But there's not much more room on the whole thing for advertising, unless they're going to do kind of like a pre-roll, post-roll, probably pre-roll, or at least some kind of a small banner on the bottom or top of the various video feeds. I guess that's what they're going to probably go for, try to get all these people that are streaming something to sign up for, you know, advertising, and they have a good stream. They can then monetize it and make Twitter money and try to get this going. But meanwhile, I see a lot more negative sides to this. I see that this is going to open up the world of black market concert videos and sporting event videos and all sorts of streams that would otherwise be not available. But they're going to have a hard time with this. Twitter's going to have a hard time with this whole Periscope app, because I do believe that they're going to be constantly under major surveillance, finding out where there's going to be any kind of, I guess, a breach of copyright infringement, and any other kind of use of and rebroadcast of an event that is outside of the ability for an individual to do. I don't know how they're going to police this. I don't know how they're going to watch this. There may be some way that they'll come up with a, possibly like what YouTube does, when there's a song that's being played that's embedded inside of a video that is up there, and they could somehow find out through their various computer algorithms that this is not allowed to be used. They pull the video off. Maybe there'll be some kind of an algorithm that they'll be used to see if it's a live event that's copyrighted and it's not able to be rebroadcast and therefore shut it down. I don't know how they're going to do it. In the meantime, it's going to create a lot of scrutiny. Maybe for the benefit to bring on users and to bring on engagement on Twitter. But again, I don't see how they're going to monetize this whole deal. We'll have to see and wait to see what happens with that. I want to talk about what's going on with the dollar. The dollar reversed its gains. We see now that the euro is at 112. It hit 113 last week as we saw that much of the manufacturing and PMI numbers in Europe were a bit better. Inflation numbers were a bit better, and there was a concern that if that is the case, they'll have to slow down on their quantitative easing program, or better said, that their economy is looking a little better. Therefore, we're going to see that the currency of that region comes back up a bit. And as our economy has been weakening, the dollar has come down. We saw that oil moved up, came back a little bit towards the end of the week, but oil did move up to the highest point last week that we saw in 2015. Now, that's interesting. You're starting to see a lot of people scratching their heads and saying, "No, well, we thought it was going to be $40 and maybe even down to $20, but we're going to say that right now it could be as high as $60 to $75. I mean, they changed their tune, of course, with whatever the way the wind is blowing. So these analysts that come in with their expectations and they do all their research and they say, okay, well, we have this much inventory available and we're still pumping and Saudi Arabia is pumping. It looks like if Iran comes on, it'll be $15 a barrel, this and that. And now all of a sudden things have changed just weeks later. This is the same group that thought we were running out of oil and pricing oil to $200, $250 a barrel on their estimates some time ago. So you got to be careful about where you're gathering your data from and look more so at what the price action is more so than what the analysts are telling us. Because really a lot of what's going on with analysts is they want to fill up time. They want to fill up their quota on CNBC, Bloomberg, and any other site that's out there that will have them, you know, make sure that Barron's gets their fill of predictions and New York Times and Wall Street Journal. That's what it's all about, right? The whole idea of predictions gets some ink and get your name out there, and hopefully it's going to do some kind of benefit for their business. But in the end, most analysts are pretty wrong, and they don't watch the price action as much as they should. And even if they do, they're coming out with some prediction based on something. What happened with oil was that we saw a much better inventory number 2 weeks in a row, only about a million barrel build. That is far from what the 10 to 12 million barrel build was just a few weeks ago. So the whole idea that we have a world that is just slushing with oil and inventories at levels of breaching of containment, essentially, where there's nowhere else to put this oil, things materially changed in the last couple of weeks, not to mention that the dollar itself has come down in value. When you look at the relationship of dollar to oil, obviously the dollar strengthening brings oil prices down. The dollar weakening will bring oil prices up. Not so much for gold these days. Gold is just not playing well at all. We actually closed our gold position a couple of weeks back in total. Maybe last week we finished off the last piece of it. And the reason for this was that it was not playing well at all. It wasn't playing well with the dollar when the dollar was moving lower. It was kind of had a mind of its own. And even though there's supposed to be some real reasonable amount of seasonality in this time of year that would spark the price of gold, didn't happen. Even when we saw some of the concerns with the global sell-off that happened throughout certain times the last year or so, gold did not play very well. And generally speaking, there's just a much more, at this time right now, much more of a desire to sell gold, it looks like, and silver for that matter, than to hold it. So therefore, maybe it's time to put that in the background. Maybe it's time, again, looking at price action, looking at weakness in every opportunity that it gets to sell off. Maybe it's time to say to gold, for the moment, maybe it's not the best hedge at this time. We have also arrived at the climax, supposedly, for when we are going to get some kind of resolution, whether it's something we like or not, from Greece. The stall tactics can only go so far because in the end, there's only so much money that they have to continue running their government, running the country. And Greece has said that this weekend or so, they will have some kind of resolution that they're willing to stand by back to the Eurozone, ECB, IMF, etc., that they will enable us all to feel better about. Now, in light of that and in advance of that, the Greek, if you've looked at the Greek markets, they've really ramped up. The Greek markets have really done an amazing job over the last week or so in front of this potential resolution or agreement that will be happening to really spark up some interest with buyers. Maybe it was oversold. Maybe it was just a time that things had to turn around at this point because they've been so bludgeoned and so much money came out. Maybe it was simply just short sellers squaring up their positions ahead of any announcement. But I got to tell you something, it was a pretty substantial move that we saw. Now, one of the things that we did also notice was that the main speaker, aside from Tsipras, who is the head of Greece right now and running things, but his main mouthpiece that was at all these meetings is Varoufakis, was pretty much being denounced by every major minister, finance minister that sat involved with the ECB discussions for being very amateur and a gambler and just really not knowing what he's doing and threatening with no backup and et cetera. And this was interesting because he was the lead in the stall tactics. Now, he was said to be removed. He was said to be, put the clamp down on his goings on and the ability for him to negotiate really as an appeasement for the Greece and European negotiations because he was not making any headway at all. As a matter of fact, he was making a mess of things. He was making such a mess of things that most of the people that you would ever hear anything negative about, which they wouldn't do usually, were really spouting off some serious negativity about his entire process of trying to negotiate. As a matter of fact, calling his entire process a non-negotiation, just a stall tactic, saying that he was unable to really bring anything and all he was doing was creating more problems for Greece and for the European region. And as such, when the announcement came that he was removed from that, at least put in the backlight, the back burner and the back seat of this whole negotiation process, markets really rallied on that very dramatically, thinking that maybe the entire Greece government felt that, you know what, this is not working for us. He's not working for us. He's causing a lot of negative sentiment on Greece and on the negotiations and not getting us anywhere. Maybe we need to go a different route. And the idea behind all of this was that, well, if that's the case, maybe Greece is going to cave in a bit. Maybe they're going to back off their demand, even though the current government was brought in with an anti-austerity and an anti-debt discussion because of the fact that the austerity programs that they're on, the amount of debt that they have has not allowed them to expand. Their unemployment rate is terrible. Their economy is terrible. Maybe now this is a sign that they're going to back down on some of their demands. Maybe they are going to pay off their debt. Maybe they are going to continue with the austerity programs that were placed upon them to make sure that there isn't excessive spending and more debt brought on. And then therefore what would happen is more money would be released to the country in hopes of them getting out of their entire, essentially, depression, recessionary time. Bring back employment, go with the program, go with the plan, no write downs at all, et cetera, no capital controls, on and on and on. Now, I don't see that necessarily. I don't see this as a total directional change of the Greek government the other way, because they were brought in and voted in on this anti-austerity measures, as well as the fact that the people in Greece wanted a say in what's going to happen with their country. Now, I don't think they're going to pull out necessarily. It's possible, but it would be very bad for everybody involved. I don't think that they're going to go along with all the austerity programs and all the programs that have been put into place for them and all the things that they are required to do in order to maintain their stability, in order to maintain the actual flow of funds into the country. But somewhere in between, something's going to happen here. They want to make sure they appease their constituents. At the same time, they want to make sure they continue to maintain the potential for lifelines of monies into the country, because basically their finances and their money is drying up. Their cash is just disappearing very rapidly due to both cost factors, and there is a tremendous amount of flight of capital out of Greece. So in summation, just to kind of wrap this all up about Greece, this is going to be a very interesting week. This is going to be a very interesting time, and we're going to have to watch it very closely, because there is going to be some response by global markets, and particularly European markets, on whatever happens in the next week or so. Keep a watch on the Greek ETF, National Bank of Greece. We're long National Bank of Greece. Profitable. We bought that and continued buying it as it was dropping recently. And that has turned out to be a nicely profitable position right now. Not a large position, because there's just too much risk involved there. But nonetheless, if the hypothesis and thesis behind what's going on in Greece is that they're not going to just cave in, but yet there's going to be some kind of basically a conciliatory discussion, and there's going to be a consensus that is somewhere in between the idea of what the government wants and what the ECB wants and the Eurozone wants, things may not be so bad. I had some questions that came in from listeners. You can always write me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. The first one's from Hashim. He said, could you please talk about some steps investors could take to mitigate downside risks in their portfolio when the latter is made exclusively of funds and ETFs as opposed to direct stocks? Also, if I may ask, what are your view of fund of funds? Okay, good questions. I think that the idea that you have here about mitigating risk, I think one of the things you want to do is when you're looking to hedge downside risks, there's a few things you could do. It's very simple, really, especially when you're involved in ETFs and funds. First is, crazy as it may sound, reduce your exposure, right? If you want to reduce and mitigate some downside risk, you reduce exposure to the equity markets that you're involved in. That's first. Now, if you want to continue to hold the positions you have, you want to go very broad-based. You want to say, okay, well, if I have a diversified portfolio and I have European equities in there, for example, and I have Asian equities and I have some bonds and I have some stocks in the US, large cap, small cap, mid cap, you want to go bigger if you can to hedge out. So what you want to do is get a global short position on, or maybe you want to, for example, you want to mitigate the risk of currency moves. So whatever the holdings are in, if they're in European, and what you want to do is you want to hedge out the risk of the currency move. So you want to hedge out you can do it through options or ETFs. You want to also look at, okay, well, if I have these positions on, maybe what I want to do is buy an option on the S&P 500, which is a broad-based index, a put option potentially on that. And maybe I want to look at some of the areas around the world that I have exposure to and just simply buy some small amount of puts around there. Now, essentially what you're going to do with that, if you go to that route and to that degree of big picture hedging, is you're going to not only mitigate your risk, you're going to probably knock out risk entirely. So you're not going to get any movement at all, which therefore goes back into the idea of, well, why don't you just bring down your positions? Now, if you're so afraid to bring down positions because you don't want to lose the upside, then you can't really mitigate your risk at all, can you? So this discussion is, in one hand, there are some ideas to do what you're trying to do. On the other hand, you have to decide whether or not you're willing to take the risk of not having the long positions on. And if that's the case, I would reduce my positions. You could always add them back. I mean, that's really what you do there. All right, let's go to the next question here. This is from Martin. This is a long email. Let me see if I can Let me see if I can get through this here and maybe shorten it up. It says, I've been a long time listener and have been had an issue I was hoping you could address. So he says, not alone on this topic, I'm sure. So I have a pretty high win rate of about 80%, not including the times I get out break even. However, I'm still in the red with my investing trading because I somehow always, with capitals, win with my small ones. But as soon as I increase my position, and he says he trades in futures, it almost always is a losing trade that ends up wiping out the last 3 to 5 good trades. Terribly frustrating because it almost feels that I'm not allowing to have big wins. For example, I've had several good ideas and profited when the target was hit and then reshorted in the target, etc. Kind of moving back and forth. My ultimate target was 75, let's say, and just give me examples. And he put the extra couple of contracts on. He broke even, and in 10 minutes, bam, he lost his money. Of course, I had stops in place, but it completely wiped out several good trades. The pattern seems to be happening all the time, to the point I feel like I'm not allowed to make some big money. The gods of investing, Martin, are against you. The only idea I've had to keep is consistent trade that I could do is to keep consistent trade size all the time. But I hear some pros talk about how size should be based on the level of conviction. Please advise, losing hair. Okay, so Martin, a couple things. First of all, you need to look at your win rate in terms of, is it the longs you're winning on? Is it the shorts you're winning on? Is it the longs that you're losing on? Is it a particular time of day? Why is it that you're moving back and increasing your position sizing? And why is it that you're losing at that point? Are you taking stops in the whole position or just part? Is it moved after the fact with you? You were correct and you were just spooked out. Are you trading above the level of your comfort dollar-wise? This is a big thing. You know, you have to trade within your time frame, but also your dollar size. If you're concerned about losing money, if you put on those few extra contracts and you start to lose money, and all of a sudden it gets to you emotionally, then guess what? You shouldn't be trading that size. But one of the big things that you probably need to recognize is you need to recognize that while you are involved in a particular larger time frame trading trend, you need to stay much longer or much greater, I should say, of a positioning and sizing in that direction, sizing with that direction, rather than going the opposite direction and increasing your size there. If in fact we are in a buy the dip mental mode right now, whereas dips are being bought and you are going short and all of a sudden getting wiped out because when you go short, you see it drop below and you hit it harder and all of a sudden it comes back against you and it wipes out all your gains from the last 3 to 5 trades because you got hit on a stop on the way back up. Realize that maybe you should be just and only increasing your size with the prevailing trend. I think that would help you a lot. We have a very liquid market right now with all of the excessive amount of stimulus that has been put in place by central banks around the world. And if you're going to fight that by trying to lever up on the trade in the wrong direction, that could be problematic. So maybe try to find out what the prevailing trend is, the bigger picture, the longer time frame. If you're trading, let's say, 60-minute time frames, take a look at the daily. What is the prevailing trend? And only lever up or only increase your positions and stack higher if it's in that direction and keep the trade size the same if you're going in the opposite direction of the trend. Hopefully that helps. Again, you can write me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Anytime, any questions that you have, I'll be happy to either answer them on the air on the show or I'll answer them directly for you. And one more question we have from Anthony. He says, hey, Andrew, I have a question for the show. Everybody talks about moving averages like they're the holy grail. But when I look at them on charts, they seem pointless because they rarely seem to act as support or resistance. So he gave me an example of a chart of the S&P 500 on a daily basis. And he threw a couple of different moving averages in there. I believe a 20-day, a 50-day, and I think a 200-day there. Let me look here. That's what it looks here. Now, and he says, you know, looking at the daily price and how the moving averages work, they just go through the prices without acting as resistance or support. What's the story? Okay, a couple of things. First of all, moving averages are to be used as guidelines. Oftentimes you find that the 50-day and the 200-day are those that are usually found to be bought. If you start to look at those as absolutes, you miss the point here. You should be looking at the slope of the moving average. If it's up or down, get the trend. You should be looking at the differential in the slope between, let's say, the 50 and the 200. Is one moving up at a different rate than the other? Is it crossing down? Where is it going? Where is it in relationship to it? Where's the price in relationship to the 50-day? Where's the price in relationship to the 200-day? Does that make sense? Now, one of the things you should know is that these are not going to be absolute, like I said. But if you do look at your chart and you do look at where oftentimes you'll see the move that does either stop very close to or close right at or above or become a magnet for. So once you pass through the 50-day, the next thing you want to look for is, okay, that support was broken. Therefore, the support is broken. Downside, where's the next stop? 200-day or the 100-day. These are levels that you can look at in terms of where the relationship is of the price and the direction of it and where the potential next level of support or resistance is. And the holy grail, it's not, but a lot of investors and a lot of institutions, a lot of money managers, a lot of hedge funds, they use these. They use these as places that they will have lines in the sand. If the 50-day moving average is held and it holds for two days after coming back into it, it's an area that I am comfortable at buying. If it breaks the 50-day moving average, then therefore I am going to close that position and I am going to look for the next level of support. I will look for the 100-day, and I will continue buying there. If it doesn't hold there, I'll pull my position and I will look for the next level of support, the 200-day. So this is the mindset of many people out there, and that's where you have to gain the respect of these moving averages, not because they were anything more than a psychological level that others are very closely watching, particularly where the big money is on the from the big money when it comes to institutions and other money managers. So don't look at these as absolutes. Look at these as guidelines. Look at these as relationships to the price. Look at these as relationships and potential stopping points, or at least areas of interest, because you can't just buy it automatically. Now, there are some money managers that will look at a stock and absolutely buy a stock on their 50-day moving average if it comes in, because they say, you know what, it comes in, it usually holds, and I'm going to buy at that level. So remember, stocks are a little different than the index. Trading is a little bit different than investing. So when you're looking at the stock versus the index, I would say that the moving averages are much better held oftentimes by stocks, because the managers can actually do a lot more to hold the stock at a particular level because the volume is a lot less and a lot less to push things around a little bit. When it comes to an index, use it as a basis for relationships. I hope that answered your questions. So next week we have coming up the official unemployment rate. We're expecting a pretty good number. If you look at the initial claims and the current trend of employment for most underlying indicators that we see on the economics, and you see that there has been a continuation of very good hiring. There's been a tremendous amount of shortness of some jobs. We did see that some retail is probably going to be laying off, and the oil patch maybe reach the pinnacle of where they're going to stop laying off as many. But you look at the initial claims and you look at all the data that we've seen on employment, and that is absolutely unquestionably a bright spot in our economy, even though we're seeing that the various service and manufacturing indices have come down. Construction spending came down. GDP at a 0.2, expecting to be maybe about 1% next quarter. So generally speaking, the economy is not doing well, but we are seeing employment do well. And without all sorts of explanations of why that is, which is kind of an aberration, really, the fact is that is something that is going to be watched by markets very closely. And as such, we're going to see some significant movement in the dollar, probably in commodities too, by the end of this week. On Wednesday, we'll have the ADP number come out that will give us the first hint of what's going on with the employment numbers. So we're going to watch that very carefully. We'll see initial claims again on Thursday as well. And then the BLS numbers come out before the market opens on Friday. So we're going to keep a very close eye on that. Make sure to listen to DH Unplugged. We have that comes out Tuesday night late. You'll see it also on Wednesday if you're on iTunes or wherever. You can go to dhunplugged.com and get it immediately. Or follow me on Twitter. Andrew Horowitz, one word, is my Twitter handle, and you can follow me there. I encourage you to do so. And you'll get all of the podcast information and releases pretty much right when they come out. I want to thank you for joining me. If you have any questions, go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. We'll have all the information from this particular episode in the show notes right there. And of course, you can find out more about the Aero strategy, which I think you want to check out, as well as the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth strategy and our global allocation strategy. Thanks for joining me, and I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.